What's doing that? That's really strange. Oh, it's happening whether, regardless of what I do. Ah, maybe it's being caused by my computer. Unplug the computer and let's see if it stops. Radio frequency interference to a certain extent. Oh well, only when it's charging. Anyway, I'm mostly known for my work on free software, software that respects the user's freedom, for launching the development of the GNU operating system, which together with which Linux, the kernel, is used. But that's not what I'm going to speak about today. I'm here to speak about a danger that threatens all development of software and all use of software. The danger of patented software ideas. Now, to avoid certain confusion, I'd like to start by pointing out that patents and copyrights have essentially nothing in common. Forget you ever heard them treated as if they were related, because they are not related. They are totally different laws that do different things. They're not interchangeable, and they don't work the same. So, for instance, a copyright covers a specific work and covers the details of expression of that work. A patent covers an idea. It's a monopoly on using an idea. Copyright doesn't cover ideas at all. They're explicitly excluded under copyright law. Now, another important difference is that copyrights exist automatically. Anything that's written is automatically copyrighted. However, patents are issued by a patent office in response to an application. The application fee costs a lot of money, but paying the lawyers to draw up the application so that it will be accepted is even more expensive. Now, copyrights last essentially forever. Under present law, copyrights can sometimes last 150 years. Patents last for 20 years, but even that's a long time when you look at the field of computing. Now, another interesting point is that a copyright is a restriction on copying, and only on copying. If you spend a year hiding in a cave with no communication to the outside world, and you come out with a manuscript of a novel, but during that year someone else wrote and published an identical novel, then you have a defense if you're accused of copyright infringement, because you can prove you didn't copy it. You had no chance to copy it. You were in the cave. However, a patent is an absolute monopoly on using the idea that is patented. Even if you can prove that you thought of the idea on your own, it's simply irrelevant. It makes no difference. You're still forbidden to use it. And this means that copyrights and patents have totally different effects on software developers. If you write a program yourself, then nobody else has a copyright on it. The only one who'd have a copyright on it is you. But if you write a program yourself, you must be using ideas that you have learned from others. And those ideas might already be patented, which means that if you write a program yourself, you can be sued for that. Sued by patent holders. Now, most of the time when people describe the patent system, they are people who have a vested interest in it. Maybe they work for the patent office. Well, the patent office always wants patents to be more pervasive, to affect more areas of life. That means the patent office gets to be bigger and gets to have an influence, which means essentially obstruction, over more people doing more things. So they tend to be in favor. It's hard for them to ever say that patents in some area would be a bad thing. Or maybe they're patent lawyers, and they get paid to write patent applications, and then they get paid to go to court about patents. So of course, they want more patents, which means more business. Now, if you confront them with this, they will do something that lawyers frequently do. They will answer in a way that is not false and appears to respond to the question, but when you think about it carefully, you'll see that they have slightly changed the subject and that the response doesn't really connect with the issue at hand. For instance, I've heard lawyers say, "I'm not always in favor of patent holders. I work for defendants too." And that's true. They're like mercenaries who sometimes work for the aggressor and sometimes work for the defender, but they want to have lots of war going on. So they're in favor of causing more war because that means more business for them. And sometimes the people who describe the patent system work for the patent departments of large corporations. So of course they're going to be in favor of the work that they do. The Economist once compared the patent system to, quote, a time-consuming lottery, unquote. Now, if you've ever seen the publicity for a lottery, you know how it works. They focus all their attention on the unlikely possibility that you win and don't talk about the overwhelming likelihood that you lose. And in this way, without actually lying, they arrange to give a false picture and encourage people to get confused and to think wrong. The publicity for the patent system works the same way. They generally describe the patent system from the point of view of somebody who's hoping to benefit from it. They describe what it's like to apply for a patent, to get a patent, and what it's like to walk down the street with a patent in your pocket, and every so often you could pull it out and point it at somebody and say, "Give me your money." So, to counterbalance what they do, I'm going to describe what the patent system looks like from the other side, from the point of view of its victims, those who want to develop and use software. So, suppose you're in a country that allows software ideas to be patented, and you want to develop a program, and you want to try to work with the patent system. What do you have to do? Well, one thing you need to do is find the ideas in your program that might be patented. This is essentially impossible. And the reason is that there are many different ways to slice up the same thing. So if there are four things that your program does, there are actually 15 combinations that might be patented. There could be a patent on this one, or a patent on this one, or a patent on these two, or a patent on this one, or these two, or these three, right? Every one of these 15 combinations, except the null combination, could be patented by someone. In fact, all 15 of them could be patented. Another thing you need to do is find all the patents that might restrict your program. This is impossible because the patent office is considering patent applications now, which are secret, and they may result in patents issuing later, which will then prohibit your program. And there's no way you can find out about them. In Europe, patent applications are published after 18 months. That's still plenty of time for you to develop a program and release it, only to find out afterwards that it becomes patented. And this is not just a theoretical possibility. In 1984, the Compress program was written. using the LZW data compression algorithm. The author found that algorithm in a journal. This is back when we thought that computer science journals existed to tell us about techniques we could use in programming. Well, at the time in 1984, there was no patent in the US on the LZW compression algorithm. A patent was issued in 1985. So at that point, it became dangerous to use compress. But the patent holder was cunning. The patent holder didn't tell people immediately, don't use compress. They waited. They thought, let's let these people dig their hole deeper so that when we attack, it'll be harder for them to run away. And then we can really screw them. So by the late 80s, it was clear that using compress was dangerous. So I began looking for some alternative. I made a public announcement, who could come up with another way to do this? And somebody said he had been developing a program for a year and wanted to contribute it to us. A few months later, we were just about to release this program when I happened to see the New York Times on the day of the week of the weekly patents column. This only happened two or three times a year. And it said somebody had got a patent for inventing a new method of compressing data. And I thought, uh-oh, we better look at this. And sure enough, it covered the program we were about to release. So that program died just before it was born. Eventually, someone else found another method. And he looked at dozens of patents to make sure it wasn't patented. And that program became GZIP. And the same code is used in WinZip. So this is now the standard method of data compression when you have a file and you want to compress it. So this sounds like a happy outcome, but I'll tell you more about it later. So you can't find out about all the patents that might prohibit the program you're writing today. But you can find out about the issued patents, because those are published by the Patent Office. You could get the whole stack. In the US, there are hundreds of thousands of software patents, I believe. The European Patent Office has issued 35,000 or so. So you could get the whole stack, but that would be too much. You could never, unless you're going to make this a full-time job, you could never understand them. So what you need to do is try to find the ones that are relevant. And the only way to do that is to use some kind of computerized search technique. And those techniques will find you lots of patents that you need to study, but they are not 100% reliable. For instance, there was, until fairly recently, a software idea patent in the US which covered natural order recalculation in spreadsheets. This means that it recalculates the cells, doing each cell after the ones it depends on, so that they all end up consistent. The earliest spreadsheets ran in very small computers, and they recalculated top to bottom, always. Which meant if you had upwards dependencies, sometimes you'd have to type recalculate, 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 recalculate to make it propagate up until everything was consistent. Once computers got a little bit bigger and space was not so tight, they decided to make the computer do this for you. So, that was a nice feature. It was implemented using an algorithm, and still is, I suppose, implemented using an algorithm called topological sort. Now, once somebody asked me for a copy of this patent, so I looked up the number in our files, pulled up this patent, copied it, and mailed it to him. And a week later, he said to me, "I think you sent me the wrong patent. This is something about compilers." So I looked in our files again, pulled up that patent, and yeah, what I got was something that said a method for compiling formulas into object code. So I wondered, what's going on here? I started reading the claims, and yes, it was the natural order recalculation patent. But that patent didn't mention the term spreadsheet. And it didn't mention the term natural order recalculation. It didn't mention the term topological sort. Although, it described dozens of different variants for how to implement topological sort. So, if you had been searching for patents relevant to developing a spreadsheet, you wouldn't have found this. The only way you'd have heard about it is if somebody said he was getting sued. However, if you search, you'll find lots of relevant patents. You'll get a big stack. Maybe not all 35,000, but still pretty big. At that point, you have to figure out what they mean. Now, this is not exactly impossible, but it's very hard. Patents are written in twisted legal language, and the words don't mean what you think they mean. So, in order to figure out what the patent prohibits you from doing, you're going to have to spend a lot of time working with a lawyer. Now, one of the supposed justifications, motivations for having a patent system is to encourage ideas to be published. The idea is that engineers can read patents and thus learn what others have figured out. But it doesn't work this way. In the 1980s, the Australian government commissioned a study of the patent system. And it concluded that there was no evidence that the patent system did Australia any good at all. And they said that if not for international pressure, they would recommend abolishing it. But that because of the international pressure, they instead would recommend making patents harder to get, last a shorter time, and be narrower in scope. And in particular, they found that only a small fraction of engineers ever read a patent. Why would you go to so much trouble just to learn what you're not allowed to do? So, and they quoted an engineer saying, "I can't recognize my own inventions in patentees." And I've seen that with my own eyes. One Paul Heckel developed a program that was somewhat interesting for looking at data and getting more information into the limited screen area that was available. And based on ideas in this program, he got a couple of patents. And when he first saw HyperCard, he didn't think that it related to his patents. It wasn't much like his program. It didn't use what he thought of as his ideas. But his lawyer pointed out to him that the way the patents were written, they could be read as covering aspects of HyperCard. So he started threatening Apple. And when Apple did not rush to pay him money, he started threatening Apple's customers because the users also can get sued. And eventually, Apple made a settlement with Heckel. And the settlement is secret. That's usually the case. The patent lawsuits that we hear about that are public knowledge are just a tiny fraction of all the threatening that goes on, which is usually secret. And the outcomes are usually secret, too. So there's no way we can tell whether he succeeded in squeezing a lot of money out of Apple, or whether he just got a tiny amount saying, please go away. Now, I once spent an hour or so looking at claim number one of one of his patents, trying to find a simple way to describe to people what the patent covers. And I couldn't find anything simpler than to restate, to paraphrase the words of the patent itself. And that statement is so complicated that it is, even though it's short, it's really hard to grasp, and I can't keep it in my head. Now, I once gave this speech in Silicon Valley. And it turns out that Paul Heckel was in the audience. And that after I got through this part, he jumped up and said, "That's not true. I just didn't understand the scope of my protection." And I said to him, "Yes, that's what I said." And at that point, he sat back down and didn't utter another word. So Heckel tried to heckle, but he wasn't that good at it. I suppose if I had said no to him, he would have argued with me. But he didn't know how to argue with yes. Anyway, you're going to spend a lot of time talking with a lawyer and about each patent. And eventually the lawyer will tell you something like this: if you do something in this area, you'll probably lose the lawsuit. If you do something in this area, there's a considerable probability you'll lose the lawsuit. And if you really want to be safe, stay out of this area. But keep in mind, there's a substantial element of chance in the outcome of any lawsuit. So now that you have predictable, clear rules for how you can do business, what are your options? For each patent, there are three things you can try to do. One thing you can try to do is avoid the patent, which means don't use the patented idea. Another thing you can try to do is get a license to use that patent. And the third thing is you can try to overturn the patent, prove it's invalid. Now, each of these may sometimes be possible, depending on circumstances. So let's look at them one by one. First, to avoid the patent. Well, that means don't use the idea, and that may be easy or hard depending on the idea and the circumstances. For instance, I saw a patent once covering a faster version of the fast Fourier transform. Runs about twice as fast. Well, if your program just has to do an FFT once in a while, and that's a small fraction of the program's time, you can surely use the ordinary FFT, which is not patented. It'll be good enough. So in that case, you can easily avoid that other idea. But if your program spends all of its time doing FFTs, and even on a very expensive computer runs just barely fast enough with the faster algorithm, then you can't avoid it. If you switch to the ordinary FFT, your program just wouldn't work. But that's going to be rather rare. That patent is not going to be a big problem to society, I expect. On the other hand, there are times when you can't avoid a particular algorithm. Consider the LZW data compression algorithm that I talked about. It was used in one data compression program, but we found another data compression algorithm which runs faster and compresses the data better. So all the people who wanted to compress their files, they switched to our better algorithm. Sounds like a good outcome. But what about the people who wanted to use PostScript? The PostScript language specification says there's an operator for LZW compression and another operator for LZW uncompression. Well, no other algorithm will do. It's no use that we have a better data compression algorithm. It's not the one specified. And there's no other algorithm that's compatible with LZW. They all compress data differently, and you have to uncompress it differently. Well, we barely squeaked through avoiding that patent. It turns out, first of all, that the patent does not cover uncompression by itself. It only covers uncompression together with compression. So if you write a program that can only uncompress, you're safe. And the other thing is, most people don't ask their printer to do compression. So we can't fully implement the PostScript spec. But we could implement the part that people actually used. So we barely snuck through. And what about the people who wanted to make GIF files? GIF format uses LZW compression also. Now, it didn't take long for somebody to design a replacement for GIF format. It's called Ping, for Ping's Not GIF. And it uses the GZIP algorithm. And so we asked people, stop, please, everybody, stop using GIFs. Switch to Ping format. Help avoid this, help our whole, the whole World Wide Web get out of this trap. And they didn't listen. We even had Burn All GIFs Day. It didn't work. If you look around the network, you'll still see lots of GIF files and only a few Ping files. The user said, well, we could consider switching, but it would be work, and besides, the browsers don't support Ping format. And then we spoke to the browser developers, and they said, well, we'll implement it someday, but the users aren't asking for it. It's basically as hard as convincing everybody in Germany to speak Swahili instead of German. Because it's a matter of convincing people to change their language. A format or a protocol that people have become accustomed to speak, that's become a de facto standard, is something that people have a big investment in, and it's almost impossible to get them to change. So when a de facto standard is covered by a patent, that's a real disaster. Now it turns out there are actually two patents covering GIF. They both cover the LZW compression algorithm. In other words, the same algorithm has been patented twice in the US. Now, you might wonder why that happened. It's not supposed to happen. They're not supposed to issue two patents for the same thing. Well, I think the reason why is that you have to look at these patents and think about them for a while before you can figure out that they're the same thing. They don't look the same. They just describe the same mathematical operations. But the only way to tell they're the same is to study them both together, or to study them both keeping in mind the LZW algorithm. Patent examiners don't have time to study every pair of perhaps related patents together. It would take too much time. They're under pressure to make the quota. In the European Patent Office, I'm told that the examiner gets a point for every patent, either every application, either accepted or rejected. But it's a lot more work to reject one, so they usually accept it. And the last thing they want to do is a thorough, careful job, because then they'd be penalized. They'd be told, you're not moving the product through. Patent offices tend to look at patent applicants as their customers, especially when they're funded by patent applications. They want to just encourage more applications, and they want to give the applicants what they want. So, I think it's not just an accident that they issued two patents for the same thing. And besides, this isn't the only time. Remember that algorithm that we were going to release and then it was killed off before it was born? Well, that was patented twice also. So apparently this happens pretty often. Well, we used to think that JPEG was at least safe. But a couple of years ago, somebody said that he had a patent that he claimed covers JPEG format. Now, JPEG is not a de facto standard. It's an official standard issued by a standards committee. This committee looked at the patent and said, in their opinion, the patent does not cover JPEG format. Who is right? Well, a court's going to decide. There's a lawsuit going on now in the US. Another commonly used standard that's covered by a patent is MP3. So as a result, people have put a lot of work into finding another format. We're having a bit more success at convincing people to switch to Ogg Vorbis format than we did in convincing them to switch to Ping format. So don't use MP3 format. Switch to Ogg Vorbis and spread the word. So those, however, are fairly light cases, one or two patents applying to a standard. Take a look at MPEG-2 video. I saw a list with 39 different US patents that supposedly cover aspects of MPEG-2 video format. It took longer to negotiate a scheme for people to license those patents than it did to develop the standard itself. And the people in the committee that developed the JPEG standard say that prospective standardization is now almost impossible because of software idea patents. The swamp of patents is so dense that they can't get through it. So, sometimes it's impossible to avoid a patent on an algorithm, even if you have a better algorithm to do the job. And sometimes a patent is so broad that it walls off an entire field. For instance, the field of public key encryption, which is of great social importance, was off limits in the US because of one very broad patent until 1997. There was simply no way to do it. Now, sometimes a patent covers a feature, and to avoid the patent, you have to avoid implementing the feature. Around 1990, the users of the word processor Xyrite received a downgrade in the mail. The downgrade removed a feature that you could define abbreviations. The idea was you could say, these three letters shall be an abbreviation for me, and every time I type them followed by punctuation, they will turn into this string. Well, that's a convenient feature, but they had to take it out. You see, it turns out that in the 1980s, somebody got a patent on that feature, and then he started threatening Xyrite. They tried negotiating a license, but they found out, they decided that it was impossible to negotiate with that person. He kept changing his demands. So eventually they decided to take the feature out instead, and they sent the users a downgrade. Now, if you take out one feature from your word processor, perhaps people will still think it's a pretty good word processor. But once you've taken out 20 features or 50 features, people are likely to think that it's a lousy word processor, and why would they ever want to use it? Now, the reason I found out about that downgrade is they wrote to me because they'd heard that my text editor, Emacs, had had a similar feature starting in the 1970s. So this means I've had at least one patentable idea in my life. I know. Anyway, eventually that patent was overturned, partly on the strength of the work I had done in Emacs. So one software idea patent down, hundreds of thousands to go. So, that's the possibility of avoiding the patent, which sometimes is possible and sometimes is not. The second possibility is to get a license for the patent. The patent holder doesn't have to offer you a license. The patent holder can say, shut down, go out of business. And this sometimes happens. I got a letter once from somebody whose family business was developing computerized casino games, building them and selling them. And of course, at that time they were computerized. And he was threatened by a patent holder who said that he just wouldn't tolerate any competitors, you have to shut down. He wrote to me seeing if there was any help I could offer, because I started one of the first efforts to fight against software idea patents. Well, I looked at this patent, and claim one described
a system with multiple computers on a network where each computer supported more than one game and could display more than one game session at a time. That's it. Now, I'm pretty sure that there were universities in the 1980s that set up networks of workstations, and these workstations that had Windows systems on them, and that they installed more than one multiplayer game. And by doing that, they would have done exactly what was described in claim one of this patent, but probably without ever thinking of this as an invention. In fact, probably without ever thinking of these two different steps as if they were one thing at all. But the patent system has a rather low standard for what's patentable. In the US, they say new, useful, and unobvious. They have slightly different wording in Europe for a similar thing. But practically speaking, it tends to mean unobvious to somebody with an IQ of 80. But this is not because the patent examiners are stupid. It's because they're following a system, and the system's rules set the threshold very low. In the patent system, if somebody does something once and somebody else can do it multiple times, they think that's an invention. If somebody did thing A and somebody else did thing B, and somebody makes something that can do either A or B, they think that's an invention. Now, we know that the first of these is a while statement and the second is a switch statement. So these are fundamental principles of computing. If you can do it once, you can do it multiple times. If you can do this, if you can do that, then you could do this or that. But they think these things are enough to make an invention. So there was no help I could offer, and that guy went out of business. However, many patent holders will offer a license. The natural order recalculation patent was being licensed for 5% of the sales price of a spreadsheet. Now, maybe you could afford one such license, maybe you could but what happens when there are 20 such patents? And then what happens when patent holder 21 comes along? Well, that's an amusing absurdity, because people in business told me that two or three such licenses would be enough to make the business fail. You'd never get close to 20 of them. Now, there are some software developers for which getting a patent license is generally painless. These are the mega corporations. The reason is they have many patents in their fields, and they can make most everybody else cross-license with them. So they cross-license with each other, and the result is they are up on the top of the cliff, and we, all the rest of us, are at the bottom looking up at this cliff, and there's very little chance we could ever get up there. So, here's how it works. IBM published an article in Think magazine, issue number 5, 1990, saying that IBM got two kinds of benefits from its portfolio of 9,000 active US patents. What is this? Is it water or is it soda?
It's soda.
Oh, no thanks.
No thanks?
I don't like soda without sugar. Well, tea would be nice.
Oh,
well, by the way, if you ever think about buying something made by Coca-Cola Company, first take a look at killercoke.org. There is a worldwide boycott of Coca-Cola Company for things like murdering union organizers in Colombia and sucking up all the water around their factory in India so that the people who live around there now have to drink from the polluted river instead.
But it's Coke automatic. This is the only thing that's not from Coca-Cola.
Well, then I won't drink anything because I just
I don't want soda without sugar, and I don't have any sugar.
Thanks for trying. Well, actually, if you pour some, if you get some water from the faucet, that would do fine. I know this may be shocking in Germany, but you can actually pour water out of the faucet and drink it. And I find it tastes just fine, usually, in Germany.
It is fine.
So IBM said it got two kinds of benefits from its portfolio of 9,000 active U.S. patents. One benefit was collecting money, but the other benefit was gaining access to the patents of others, meaning practicing cross-licensing. And it said that the second benefit was perhaps an order of magnitude greater, their words, than the first, meaning around 10 times as big. Now, what does this mean? The patent system is like a lottery. Its effects on a small company vary wildly with chance. But IBM is so big that it can do us the favor of measuring the average. And the average it measures is, the harm it'll do you is 10 times or so as big as the benefit. Now, why is this? They estimate the benefit that they got from not being threatened with the patents of others. Well, that's a measure of the amount of harm the patent system would have done in the world where they didn't do cross-licensing. Now, that harm does not really happen to IBM, because IBM does do cross-licensing. So IBM gets only the benefit. The harm, the potential harm, doesn't happen for IBM. But for small companies, which don't have thousands of patents or even hundreds of patents, they can't do what IBM does. They can't prevent this harm. So it really happens to them. And thus, the big companies like IBM, they get only the benefits. And this is counterbalanced by the harm on small companies. On the average, the harm will be 10 times the benefit. So on small companies, on the average, it's causing harm. But that's counterbalanced, equaled by the good it does for the big companies. And thus, you see that that having patents tends to pressure an industry to become more concentrated, more a matter of big companies, to have more barriers to entry. And some people like to describe this unfortunate state of affairs as, quote, mature, unquote. So that makes it sound like this is the natural endpoint that we should be glad to see. Look at the way they use rhetoric to take a harmful effect and make it sound both inevitable and desirable. Who could object to having something become, quote, mature, unquote? We wouldn't want it to stay immature forever, would we? So,
second try.
Well, I mean, you could have just poured it out of the faucet. I would have been perfectly happy. Oh, I do like it. It's just that you wasted some money. Water everywhere, but not a drop to drink.
This is patented, I think.
Thank you so much.
anyway, IBM can make almost everybody cross-license because it has so many patents. Sometimes you'll hear smaller companies executives saying to the staff, get us some patents, get us some patents, we have to have something to defend ourselves with. I can sympathize with that feeling. They have nothing else to defend themselves with, but it won't really work. You see, suppose a small company does get a few patents, which maybe it can do. Suppose it gets one patent pointing over there and another patent pointing over there. Well, how good are these for defense? Suppose somebody over there points a patent at this small company. These two patents are useless for defense. You see, IBM can almost always defend itself because it has thousands of patents. It has patents pointing everywhere, multiple patents overlapping, right? So if someone attacks IBM, IBM can almost always defend itself. But the small company with two patents can't possibly do that. It's hopeless. Well, once in a while they could defend themselves, but usually they can't. Meanwhile, the management of this company, or the new management after it gets acquired by some other company, might notice, hey, we've got this patent and it's pointing at those people over there and they're helpless. Why don't we attack them? So if the management is saying to you, please help us get some patents to defend ourselves, here's how I suggest responding. I perfectly understand that this company needs to try to find some way to defend itself from software patents wielded by others. However, I don't know who will be managing this company in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. And I don't know whether they will be as scrupulous as you are. So please put it in writing that these patents will be used only for defense, either self-defense or mutual defense. And then I could help this company get patents and feel completely good about it. And you'll see what response they give you. It will be at least an interesting discussion. You could also suggest to the company that it should put some effort into making sure that there are no software idea patents in Europe, because that's real defense. That's the only real defense. That's the only way your company can be safe. So point out to them that if they want to be safe, if they want to protect themselves from software idea patents, that they can do it, but only this way. Now, it's very important to understand about cross-licensing, because that is the fallacy in an argument that you will often hear. It's the argument that patents, quote, protect the small inventor, unquote. So they start with a scenario that's rather unlikely. They say, imagine that there is a brilliant designer of whatever who has been working for years in his attic to develop a better way to do whatever. And now it works. So now he's going to go into business and produce this thing. And his business will be a tremendous success, except for one thing. The big companies will immediately start to compete with it, and they will take away all of the market. And because of that alone, this business will fail, and our genius will starve. Now, this scenario is very unlikely. First of all, most of the ideas people get in a high-tech field happen because they're working in the field and working with other people, not alone in their attics. And second, just because he came up with a good invention and another idea for how to do whatever, doesn't mean he knows how to run a business. In fact, probably he doesn't. Most new businesses fail. The assumption that his business is going to succeed is unjustified, because it's probably going to fail, because he probably doesn't know how to run it. But let's suppose he does know how to run a business. In that case, it's not inevitable that big businesses will knock it out. After all, there are lots of small businesses around, even in high-tech fields. They need to However, they need to be run in such a way that they're not doing head-on competition with big businesses. Although, even if the big businesses do compete and do take most of the market, a small company can still be a success. It doesn't need so much to succeed because it's small. But let's assume that the company does fail. At that point, if this person is so brilliant and has business sense, I presume he can get a job somewhere. So he's not likely to starve. So this scenario is a series of unlikely assumptions. But let's look at it anyway. Let's suppose it happens. Their argument is that the patent system changes everything, because then our genius can get a patent. And when IBM wants to compete with him, he says, oh no, IBM, you can't compete with me because I've got this patent. And IBM says, not again, and goes away and gives up. Well, here's what really happens. IBM says, oh, you have a patent. How nice. Well, we have this patent and this patent and this patent and this patent and this patent that cover other parts of your, other aspects of your product. And if you think you can fight those in court, we'll pull out some more. So how about if you sign a cross-license agreement with us and then nobody will get hurt? And our genius, with his business sense, will realize he has no choice. So he'll sign the cross-license agreement, and IBM will say, okay, thank you, and go away and then compete with him. Which means that the patent system didn't, quote, protect, unquote, this, quote, small inventor, unquote, at all. It just doesn't do that, not nowadays. Now, there are some patent holders that IBM cannot force to cross-license. These are the companies that are described as patent parasites or trolls. Companies that produce nothing except threats and lawsuits. That have no developers or salesmen or factories, just lawyers. All they have is some patents, and they go around to various companies that really do produce something saying, we have a patent, we're going to sue you, pay us to go away and leave you alone. You might call it the patent protection racket. So, even IBM can't make them cross-license. You see, while patent lawyers love to tell us that it's just great to have patents covering your field, they have arranged not to have patents cover what they do. So there are no patents on how to word a threatening letter, or how to file a lawsuit, or how to persuade a judge. So no matter how many patents IBM has, it can't threaten these parasites. So IBM just has to pay them. But I guess IBM figures that their competitors will have to pay these parasites too. So they figure they're not at a disadvantage. Meanwhile, there are some software developers for whom it's especially hard to get a patent license. We free software developers. And the reason is, the patent license normally demands a payment per copy. And we can't do that because we can't count the copies. If I had to pay 1/1,000,000th of a euro per copy of a program, I couldn't do it. The total money might be in my pocket right now, but I can't calculate it because I don't know how many copies there are, and everyone else is free to make more copies at any time. So I can never tell how many copies there are. The patent holder can offer any terms he wants. He can offer a license for a lump sum payment, if he wants. But usually these lump sum payments are high, like $100,000. Now, the reason free software has been able to do so much for the public is that we can develop software with no money. But we can't pay license fees with no money. If we have to pay a lot of money for permission to serve the public, we can't do it. So that's the option of getting a license to use the patented idea. The third possibility is to overturn the patent. In order to be able to do this, you need to be able to make a case. Whether you have a case to make depends on facts from years ago. What was published when? And whether you can prove it today. So in effect, the dice were rolled years ago. And if you can prove that they came out favorably, then you have an argument to go to court with. If you have enough money, it's rather expensive to go to court. A few years ago, Qualcomm was a defendant in a software patent lawsuit and lost, and had to pay $13 million, of which $8 million went to pay the lawyers on both sides. The result is, if you don't have money enough to go to court, even a probably invalid, probably absurd software idea patent can be a very dangerous weapon when someone attacks you with it. It can be enough to make you go out of business. Now, there are other techniques you can try to use to get the patents out of the way. In many countries, you can file for re-examination. But unlike going to court, re-examination just means that the patent office has a chance to discuss with the patent holder ways to change the patent. Now, they may make the patent smaller. They may get rid of it entirely. Or they may even extend it. So sometimes it's a useful technique, but you've got to be careful, and it isn't always a wise idea. They may just redraw the boundaries of the patent. You know, if the patent's here and you found something done in the past that that patent covers, which means it should be invalid, and then you go get it re-examined, they may redraw the boundaries of the patent so it avoids the thing you found but still covers the thing people want to do today. And then you're really screwed. So it's a technique to be used with care. These are the three things you can try to do for each patent. So that hundreds of patents, you may encounter hundreds of them along your path, and you can try to do one of these three things. And sometimes one of them will work, and then you sweep by. And sometimes none of them will work, and then your project's dead. It becomes somewhat like Space Invaders. You can keep on killing those spaceships over and over, but always, eventually, one of them is going to get through. Now, practically speaking, developers don't try to search for all the patents. You see, it's too dangerous to do that. If you have looked at the patent, then the penalties for infringing it, if you're found to have infringed it, are greater. Which means, to be safe, you better keep your eyes shut. And that's what you do. You keep your eyes shut, and you take a step, and another step, and another step, and you hope. So, developing a program becomes like crossing a minefield. With each step, there's probably nothing is going to happen. But there's a certain chance you'll step on a software patent and it will explode and destroy your project. And you have a lot of steps to take to build a complicated program, which means the danger becomes substantial. But I must admit, there's one place where this analogy breaks down. When somebody steps on a landmine, it's not dangerous anymore. But when somebody steps on a software idea patent, it remains just as dangerous for the next guy. Plead to be excused from them.
Now that's a ridiculous supposition. It's like saying, other people get cancer, why shouldn't you? However, there is a good question buried, you know, hidden within that silly question. The good question is, how do different fields differ? How do various fields differ in ways that are relevant to deciding what patent policy should be? That question is not biased, it really looks for information. So let me give an answer. Fields vary in how products relate to patents and how patents relate to products. We have a picture of the patent system that if someone designs a new product, this product, because it's new, won't already be patented. Because we have a picture where each design for a product corresponds to one patent. So if the product is new, it won't be patented already, and whoever designed the product can get, quote, the patent, unquote, on this product. Well, it may have worked that way in the 19th century for mechanical devices. But no field works that way anymore. But fields are more or less close to this picture. For instance, the pharmaceutical field used to work this way until a few years ago. And it still sometimes, it still to a large extent works this way according to the picture. Until recently, a pharmaceutical patent covered the entire chemical formula of a drug. So if someone developed a new drug, it wasn't covered by patents already. And he could get the patent, the one and only patent covering that new drug. So it really did follow this picture. But I've been told that the field is changing. And nowadays, when somebody develops a new drug, it may be covered by existing patents already. But not too many of them. I would suppose not more than a handful of patents would cover a new drug. And they still do patent the individual chemical formulas. So pharmaceuticals has moved somewhat away from our naive picture, but it's not very far away. And then there are the other fields of engineering are sort of in the middle, and at the opposite extreme is software. One program, one product of software design can combine thousands of ideas that may be patented. Now there's a reason why software is at the other extreme. It's because in software, we are putting together idealized mathematical components. We're putting together logic. The program is simply logic operations. And because, whereas in all the other fields, engineers have to are designing physical things, so they have to cope with the perversity of matter. In software, we're designing logic that runs on a universal machine. The complications of matter are all buried, hidden inside that universal machine. The people who designed the computer had to cope with the perversity of matter. But because they've made a well-defined universal machine, we programmers can ignore all that. And that makes our work far, far easier. Designing software is inherently easier than developing mechanical things or chemical processes or electrical circuits. There are so many problems we just don't face. For instance, when I put an if statement inside of a while statement, I don't have to worry that the voltage drop through the while statement may be too great and the if statement will get too low a voltage and won't function. I don't have to worry that the while loop will cycle at the wrong speed and the if statement will have resonant vibrations and eventually it will crack. I don't have to worry that it will go much faster and produce radio frequency interference and cause wrong signals in other parts of the program. I don't have to worry about the heat generated by the if statement and whether it can escape through the while statement or whether the if statement will burn out. I don't have to worry about whether corrosive fluids might get in between the if statement and the while statement and eat away at the contact between them until eventually the if statement cracks or the voltage drop is too great or the signals just don't go through. And I don't have to worry about how, supposing this if statement cracks or burns out or corrodes, how I'm going to pull it out and put in a replacement. I don't have to worry about how, when I build each copy of this program, I'm going to physically assemble the if statement inside the while statement. When you design a physical product, in many cases you have to design the factory to produce it. Designing the factory may constrain how you design the product. And building the factory is tremendously expensive in many cases. But when I want to make copies of a program, I just type CP. The same copy command will copy any program. I don't have to design another factory to make copies of this new program I just wrote. So there's so many problems that we don't have in this field. And that makes it easier. But the intelligence spectrum of people in the software field, I presume, is the same as the intelligence spectrum of electrical or mechanical or chemical engineers or of drug designers and medical researchers. So what do we do? If you have the same intelligence, but the field is inherently easier, you do bigger problems. If you make the problem big enough, eventually it becomes a challenge. And so that's what we do. The systems that software developers develop have a lot more parts in them than the physical systems that human beings can develop. Developing a drug with thousands of atoms in it can be very hard. A program with thousands of design elements in it is trivial. We do millions. We can do that because our field is inherently easy. So, what does that mean? It means that the number of ideas we can combine in one program is a lot more than the number of ideas a mechanical or electrical or chemical engineer can combine in one product or one factory. Because we can just toss them off. It's so easy for us to put in another idea. You just have to write the code to do it. Well, you put together thousands of ideas, it adds up to a big job. Writing, you know, maybe a million lines of code, it takes time. Yeah. In other fields, it may take just as much time to get something working with just 1,000 parts. Because the field is so hard. So this means that a phenomenon happens to us that's, well, it's, you can find it sometimes in other fields, but not so big. For instance, look at mechanical engineering. In the U.S., when the U.S. entered World War I, nobody in the U.S. could make a modern airplane. And the reason is, to make a modern airplane, you had to combine a few ideas that were patented, and the patents belonged to different people who didn't get along. So nobody could use them all. The US government thought this was not acceptable, so it confiscated all these patents and paid a lump sum of money to each of the patent holders and said, okay, everybody, make airplanes. That was just a few patents, however, covering one product. With a software package, it can be hundreds. And I used to have to ask people to just extrapolate and figure this out. But now there's been a study to show it. Someone did a study of one particular program, Linux. The kernel
of the GNU/Linux system. And he found 286 US software idea patents covering ideas implemented in various parts of Linux. Now, Linux has been estimated... what does it say?
You have enough time, but keep in mind that you have to get the train.
When is the train?
2020.
2020? Yes. 8:20. Okay, I think I can finish. So, Linux was estimated at 0.25% of the system. So, we could extrapolate and make an estimate of around 100,000 software idea patents covering parts of the GNU/Linux system. That's a rough estimate. I wouldn't be surprised if it were only 30,000 or if it were 300,000. So you see how bad this problem is. And the result is the main effect of software patents is to bollocks up the works of the software field. The main job of the software field is not coming up with ideas. It's putting together so many ideas into a program and getting the details of the program right so it works smoothly. And people who are doing this will have some ideas. So if you were writing a word processor, you'd have to combine hundreds of ideas. But you'll have some new ideas, and you could put them in too. And people who see your word processor will see these new ideas, so they'll put them into other word processors and make further innovation. So as a byproduct of developing software, we get ideas. And software idea patents make no sense. They try to put a premium on the byproduct by bollocksing up the activity that generates them. It's self-defeating in its own terms. And there is now economic research showing how, in a field with incremental innovation, patents can retard progress. They can even discourage investment in research. You can find this in www.researchoninnovation.org in the paper patents.pdf. Another paper on that site shows how in the US, after there were software idea patents, the result was that companies transferred money away from research into patenting. So it's a self-defeating system, even in its own stated terms. And this is very important, because the politicians who are making these decisions usually don't know anything about software. They're not programmers and never were. So the lobbyists for the big companies, and their indirect representatives too, can make very foolish arguments, but these people don't recognize the error because they don't know what it's like. So they'll say, well, yes, it's true software idea patents cause these various kinds of trouble, but they promote progress, and that has to be more important than everything else, right? Well, I don't think so. But in fact, their assumption is unwarranted. You can't assume that software idea patents promote progress. Here we see that they can retard progress. You shouldn't just blindly assume that they promote progress. However, this is only one of the reasons there should be no software idea patents. The fact that they interfere with software development and probably retard progress, because there's lots of incremental innovation in the software field. There's another reason. In other fields, patents restrict a few specialized businesses. But in the software field, patents restrict every computer user. And that means most of society in an advanced country. This is not a mere economic issue. This is an issue of citizens and their rights. It's an outrage to tell people you're not allowed to use your computer the way you see fit because they're private monopolies restricting you. And finally, software idea patents tie up every business that uses computers in a new bureaucracy. And this is a large fraction of all businesses in advanced countries. They're not in the software field, but they use computers. They do e-commerce. And they want to be able to do this without somebody getting in their way. Now, I'm not one of those people who says that all government regulation is bad. Some government regulations serve a purpose for the general public, and then it's justified. But to add a new form of bureaucracy to interfere with business for no good reason is harmful. And that's why the European Confederation of Associations of Small and Medium-Sized Enterprises is against software idea patents. They represent some 2 million European businesses. And those businesses stand to lose if their computer operations are restricted in this way. They face a new threat of lawsuits. And they think that this is bad for business. So I'll just end by giving you a couple more arguments to use. You'll find people saying, the US has software idea patents. If Europe doesn't, Europe will be at a disadvantage. Well, they could say, the US has gang warfare. If Europe doesn't have gang warfare, Europe's at a disadvantage. The fact is, right now, Europeans have an advantage. The US has its own patent system, which only covers activities in the US. But anyone in the world can get a US software patent and then attack us poor Americans at home. But as long as Germany doesn't have software patents, then nobody in the world can get German software patents and attack Germans at home. So then you get a situation where, you know, if the European Union clearly rejects software patents, then Europeans will have an advantage. Not a perfect, total advantage, but an advantage. So be smart, keep your advantage, and maybe eventually the US government will realize it had better improve things in the US. See, the US government, when there's a problem in the US, the US government doesn't try to make things better. Instead, it tries to export the problem and impose it on the rest of the world. And that's what happens here. The US government, in issues like this, is the puppet of the megacorporations. So the US Trade Representative is trying to bully various countries into agreeing to have software idea patents. They did that with Jordan, I think they did that with Morocco, they tried that with Australia, and I think it may have just barely not worked. So that's what you're working against. And finally, one good way to explain what this is like to people who don't know how to program, like politicians usually, is to compare programs with symphonies. This is a good analogy for this purpose because a program and a symphony are both a collection of a large number of details. And in order to make it good, you have to make all the details fit together, work together smoothly. These details implement ideas. But you can't just take the ideas and plug them in. You have to implement them. The way you implement one idea is a matter of fitting together with all the other ideas you're using to make a harmonious combination. So imagine that in the 1700s, the governments of Europe had established a system of musical idea patents so as to promote the progress of music. So that any musical idea that you could express in words could have been patented. So for instance, a four-note motif could have been patented, or a sequence of chords, or the form of a movement, or using certain instruments together temporarily for a part of a piece. Any of these things could be patented. Now imagine it's 1800 and you're Beethoven and you want to write a symphony. You're going to find it's harder to write a symphony that you don't get sued for than to write a symphony that sounds good. And of course, you complain, being Beethoven,
But the patent holders would say, oh, Beethoven, you're just jealous because we had these ideas and you didn't. Why don't you go think of your own ideas? Somehow trying to suggest that Beethoven couldn't think of any ideas. Well, part of the reason we think of Beethoven as a great composer is he used a number of new musical ideas. And some of his pieces were controversial. Yeah, I see. But he had to combine them with lots of old ideas in order to make something that people recognized as music and would listen to long enough to get used to the new ideas. Nobody, not even a Beethoven, is such a genius that he could reinvent music from zero and make something that people would want to listen to. And nobody is such a genius he can reinvent computing from zero and make useful software without using the old ideas. So if we want software to be developed, if we want progress in the software field, if we want software to be available, if we want people to be able to use their computers safely, we've got to make sure there are no software idea patents. Thank you.
Now, I've got some MSF stickers, some new stickers. Take stickers if you want them. Take the amount you can use. I also have some FSF pins and key rings. In case someone wants to buy them, each is 15 euros. To raise funds for the FSF.
Of course, and thank you for your very fascinating talk and entertaining talk. You just have one single problem. If we don't succeed in getting another car, we have to leave in 5 minutes.
No.
So, we have two choices. One is if you try to get something from him, I would say.
If you want to buy it, come right now.
Yes, come right now. And we do a discussion if you like to after. Peter Gavinsky will be here later on. But Richard, the American
I don't have to sign anything. You have to